Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Always appreciate you tuning in and sharing part of your Saturday with me. Well, lots to do on the show today. Of course, we're going to be taking a look at some Halloween numbers. We spend a lot of money on Halloween, and we're going to talk about just how much. We're also going to be looking at ways to increase the ROI of college. Very expensive, and I know a lot of people in the last recession started kind of questioning why even go. So we're going to take a look at some ways to get a little more bang for your buck there. And also, we're going to take a look at how Snapchat has kind of avoided this whole fake news thing. We're going to take a look at why that might be. But right now on the phone, we have Marshall Allen, who is a reporter at ProPublica. ProPublica has been doing some really interesting work lately around drug companies and healthcare costs, and it's really, really fascinating. And I encourage you all to stay tuned and keep a close eye on that site, ProPublica.org, for all of that work. But in particular, there was a piece recently that caught my eye all about how drug companies kind of plan ahead for some degree of waste, and that cost is shifted to us. Marshall Allen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Amy. It's great to be here.
So tell us about this, because this seems immediately, you know, the knee-jerk reaction is, well, why would you take more medicine than you possibly need? But it's really kind of built in a way that it seems very unavoidable.
Well, so I'm looking, doing a series of stories this year on wasted healthcare spending. And the point of this is that this is our money, right? This is money we pay for healthcare, and a lot of it gets wasted. This particular story looked at eye drops, and it looked at single-use cancer vials, so cancer drugs used for chemotherapy. With eye drops, I don't know if you've ever had the experience of putting an eye drop into your eye and a lot of it washes down your face or rolls down your cheek. You end up having to use a tissue to wipe up some of it. I always thought, you know, that was just because I had sort of missed my eye or made a mess, but the reality is every eye drop, pretty much every eye drop on the market, is just too large for our eye. So the eye has a limited capacity of fluid it can contain, and a lot of eye drops are two or three times bigger than what our eye can even contain. And so that just means that the drug companies are making you pay for a lot more medication than you can even possibly use.
And so when you're talking about eye drops, you're talking about prescription only, or are we talking all the way down the line to like Visine and stuff like that?
Everything, every single eye drop on the market, from the cheap stuff like Visine to the glaucoma drugs that might cost hundreds of dollars per bottle.
So that's quite a bit. That's pretty significant. And that's all about kind of the bottom line there on for drug companies. And so what can consumers even begin to do about this when you're kind of, you know, if all of the eye drops are this way, your hands are a bit tied?
Well, so eye drops are different sizes, you know. So one thing they could do is, you know, if they ever got it together, they could call a drug company and ask them to put the size of the drops on the labels. You know, this causes a problem for consumers because, especially for people who use eye drops for, like, chronic conditions like dry eyes or glaucoma, and there are millions of those consumers out there, you know, they might end up running out of their drops before they can get a refill. And these are people who really need these drugs. So it matters a lot to them if they can make a drug bottle last longer. So even if they found out which drops were larger or smaller, they could avoid the big ones and go with the smaller ones.
And so they would, you're saying to go for the drops that dispense a much smaller drop.
Well, sure, because if you buy, say, you know, 2 milliliters of drops, and some drops are larger than others, you're going to get a lot more doses with a smaller drop.
And you wouldn't think this much angst would be around a single little drop, but you're exactly right, especially when you get into the eye drops that come in like little individual plastic vials. That is completely excessive, not just, you know, not just a drop here, but you're talking across the board, all of these eye drops. So let's switch to costs of cancer drugs and vials that they come in and how that's packaged.
Well, so I looked at the cancer drug Herceptin, but I could have looked at a lot of different ones. But Herceptin is very popular for breast cancer, and it's used to be packaged in a multi-use vial. So it was a vial that could be shared among patients. So there wasn't a lot of waste and, you know, wasted medicine. Then they switched earlier this year to a single-use vial that one cancer center estimated ends up costing them about $1,000 of wasted medicine per infusion. And that's billed to the patient. And so what happens is, you know, there's patients get distributed the drug based on their body weight or their body size. And so if the drug vials are too big, it just gives them more medication than they can even use.
And so this does seem a bit brazen on behalf of the drug companies. Not that I'm super surprised, but it does seem a bit brazen. So is this really just about boosting the bottom line of revenue, or is there more to this?
Well, they would never say it's about boosting the bottom line for revenue, right? I mean, what the company that makes Herceptin told me is that this makes things easier for them in the manufacturing process and in the supply chain kind of process to manufacture the drug and get it distributed. They said that the single-use vials are more commonly used worldwide, and so that's the preference. But in making this change, it just so happens that they are also selling a lot more of the drug than anyone can actually use.
Right, and shifting a lot of costs to consumers. And again, that's another area where if you need that drug, you need it. It's really probably not the time for you to be spending a lot of mental energy or time to, you know, to be dealing with drug companies and calling them. It's probably, if you need a cancer drug, you probably need to just focus on your care at that point. So again,
exactly. Yeah, these are patients who are fighting for their lives. I mean, that's a great point. And one of the doctors I talked to said that this is really, I mean, he used the word evil. You know, I mean, the fact that people are fighting for their lives and then they're being overbilled for wasted medicine that they can't even avoid, you know, there now a possible solution there, this guy suggested, was you could make them give a rebate on the unused drug. So that would incentivize them to provide the drug in a less wasteful way if they had to actually buy it back.
Right, right. And is this something that perhaps we could look with to maybe the Food and Drug Administration to regulate? Because again, the word brazen really just keeps coming up here. And so is that something the FDA would even think to tackle and kind of regulate sizing of these drugs?
Well, so not necessarily. You know, the FDA's mission is really to look at the safety and the effectiveness of drugs, not necessarily whether the drugs are wasteful. What the FDA could do, and this is what consumers could call on the FDA to do, is to, for instance, with the eye drops, put on the label of the eye drop how large the drop is. And then that way there'd be a little bit of transparency so patients could purchase things with the most doses if that's what they wanted to do.
Indeed. Well, and this is why we appreciate the good work being done by you and many others at ProPublica. So if you follow me on Twitter, I will tweet out this story a little bit later all about eye drops, cancer drugs, and how healthcare costs are very much being shifted to consumers. Thanks so much for being with us today, Marshall Allen.
Thank you, Amy.
Have a good one. All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to be looking at some of the retail numbers around Halloween. Pretty big business there. So we'll break it all down for you in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's close to midnight. Something evil's lurking from the dark. We got to let this one play for a minute.
Oh, I know.
There was a time, Griffin, that I knew this whole dance. It's radio, so let's just say I'm doing that whole dance right now. Let's just reach it. 720 WGN, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your chilly Saturday with us. Well, it is almost Halloween time. It is upon us indeed. So, of course, we had to play a little bit of Thriller as we take a look at some Halloween numbers. Griffin and Bob, are you guys planning on dressing up for Halloween? Is that a thing you're doing? Yeah, you're not feeling it. Where's Bob? Bob ran away. He didn't want to talk to us.
I hate to be boring, and I am going to.
You
a party.
Are hardly boring.
No, but in this regard, I think I am. And the last couple of years, I've like half tried, but I've found that that's even worse than just not doing it.
It is. So it's like when you go to a party, I feel like every year you see someone who just has like a pan, like a saucepan in their hand, and you're like, what's your costume? And they put it on their head, they're like, I'm a pothead. No.
I would not do that.
Come on.
I had an orange sweater, and then I cut out black construction paper and made a little jack-o'-lantern.
That's adorable.
I thought it was fine. Some of the people there were like, eh.
They're like, no.
I think my execution may have been the problem. I'm not very crafty.
Not so crafty. Eh. Well, do you want to venture a guess on how much is spent on Halloween in the U.S. I've got 2016 and numbers and a forecast for 2017. Just guess.
Oh, I think I'd be so far off. Is it in the billions?
It is in the billions.
10 billion.
Close.
Hey.
2016, it was 8.4 billion total Halloween spending. This year, it is forecast to be a record of $9.1 billion.
So it's climbing.
That's a ton. Now,
that is a lot.
Let's break down what makes up that number. One number I shouldn't be surprised by this number, but I am. 440 million of that, pet costumes.
What?
$440 million spent on pet costumes. I'm not saying that's bad. Pet costumes are extremely cute. I don't think the pet in the costume ever looks happy. No. They always look so unhappy, like, I'm not a bumblebee.
Well, and this is probably wrong, but that's half the fun, is how sad they always look, to me anyway, personally.
There's a little bit of Schadenfreude going on right now.
Absolutely. Animal, cross-species Schadenfreude.
Right.
It's true, but there's something so sweet about, like, a dog that's just...
This looks very, very sad about the whole
thing. I wonder how much that number has grown since, you know, Facebook, Instagram... sharing of costumes.
Right. Because that's part of it.
I'm sure that's had an effect on adult costumes too, but also especially on pet costumes, I feel like. Because that's the only reason you do it. This is for people to see it and think it's funny.
I mean, there are some dogs that enjoy a little sweater. So I've seen some. There's a festive dog in my neighborhood that has like a little, his sweater looks like a candy corn. And I saw him this morning.
Hey,
he was very cute.
That's cute.
And he seems fine. He's like, whatever, it's a sweater. I don't care. But that number is up from 420 million last year. Of that, making up that number of $440 million spent on pet costumes, 29 million Americans are dressing up their pets this year. That's a ton of people.
That's a third of the country.
That's a whole lot of people. 2.7 billion.
Not a third. I'm sorry. I'm just quick. I said the wrong thing.
Yes, you did. It's fine. I was going to let it go and bust your chops later. 2.7 billion will be spent on candy. See, that seems like an appropriate number to me.
Say it again. It was
$2.7 billion spent on candy.
That's a lot.
That seems reasonable. Especially because, you know, you like
reasonable.
Eat half of it. There is an ad that I do kind of enjoy right now for Halloween candy. It's so silly and simple, but it makes me laugh very much, probably because I've lived it a little bit in my life. It is, I think, for Reese's. It's Kit Kat. And so there's a bunch of kids outside, and the parent says, what house do you want to go to first, kids? And they go, the cat lady. And it cuts to the woman, and she's surrounded by cats all in a bunch of costumes. And she's like, it's go time, kitty cats. That one makes me laugh so much, but that's a very cute one. Okay, so $2.7 billion on candy. 49% of Americans will decorate their home or yard. $2.7 billion spent on decorations for home and yard. The average person buying decorations will spend $25.24. I'm going to say my neighborhood might be a little ambitious in that area. There's a couple of houses that they go all out for Halloween.
Yeah, like what kind of the gravestones? That was a big one in my neighborhood growing up, I remember.
Yeah, there's some cute gravestones. There's one, and they have a bunch of different kinds of skeletons. Like there's the hands coming out of the ground, but also like a snake skeleton and a alligator skeleton. But there's one house in particular, they have lights in the yard with projections of really very realistic looking ghosts happening, swirling around the house. It's a very modern looking house, so they have this flat surface to work with, and they've done the cobwebs well.
Yeah.
You can't just open that and hang it on the fence. You got to really pull those cobwebs
apart.
It's
an art form. My parents bought this thing for inside the house where it's a TV. It looks like an old timey TV. And if you press a button on it to like turn on the TV, it goes to static. And then a face appears, like a skeleton face, and it comes out of the TV. Like,
that's not horrifying at all.
It's because the actual screen is something like, it's some fabric that's...
Oh.
So it literally comes out.
How big is this decoration?
I don't know. It's like...
Like, it's real size of a TV.
Yeah, but a small TV.
Okay.
It's horrifying. And then it starts, like, screaming. It's so... I was like, get that out of here right now.
There's always the decorations that are, like, in the store this time of year. You just walk by it and something starts screaming at you when you're like, I didn't press the button.
Don't like that.
But I have a neighbor who... So my bedroom window faces a street. And I have a neighbor who had this really elaborate stuff going on. They've got like these purple lights and it looks really spooky, and it's kind of an older house anyway. And so it's perfect for like the haunted house kind of vibe. And they have this big, I don't know what he is, some kind of Grim Reaper thing in the front yard, and it looks very spooky. And they have some, you know, things that light up, but during the day it's a different look. And I realized that I saw them putting it up on, and the first night I go to bed and turn off the lights, and then I turn the other way. And so I'm facing the window for a second. I realized the only thing I can see in the darkness is these red glowing eyes right at my bedroom window. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to talk with him about that.
Did you say, hey, can we not?
I didn't say, can we not? But I was like, hey, fun fact, you know what? When it's really dark, because there's not a street light right there. So I was like, when it's really dark, I can only see these glowing red eyes. They're like, did you want us to take it down? I'm like, no.
Well, you have to wonder if it was intentional, if they're messing with you on purpose. I don't know.
I mean, my window is the only one.
How well
right
do you know them? That's the question.
I wondered about those neighbors.
Very scary.
Skipping their house for trick or treat, for sure. All right. Well, so lots of numbers, but 9.1 billion is the one we're looking at. That's the one that is projected to be spent total on Halloween stuff in the U.S., which is big bucks.
How much of that is coming from you? Are you going to buy any candy? Or
no, I live on a top floor, so it's kind of tricky with the trick-or-treaters. I'll just get myself a Kit Kat and be like, oh, look, this is left over just for me. Yay.
Celebrating.
It's go time, kitty cats. that's what
you.
I'll do.
We learned so much. You know the thriller dance, and that's you're the cat lady.
And cats are my friends. Okay. So we're going to go to break, and we're going to get you to news and all that good stuff. And when we come back, we are talking about how to increase the ROI of your college education. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hi there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. A little bit later in the show, we're going to be talking with a reporter at Bloomberg about how Snapchat has been able to pretty much avoid this whole fake news issue. So we're going to take a look at how Snapchat could have possibly done that. But right now, joining us on the phone is John Hupalo, who is the CEO and founder of Invite Education. Hi, John. Welcome to the program today.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So you have a really interesting blog post lately, just recently, that I really took an interest to, because it was all about maximizing the ROI of college. And we think about that, and immediately you're like, well, study hard, do well, don't go nuts and party too hard, good enough. But you're really taking a look at some specific tactics that students can put in place to really come out ahead at the end. So if you would, talk us through that.
Well, Amy, thanks. And I have to give my alma mater, Boston University, a lot of credit for this, because I had the exact reaction that you did when they called me to say, we want you to come to Parents Weekend and talk to current students and parents about how they can afford college better and what they can do to increase their return on investment. And honestly, my first reaction was somewhat skeptical. I think that the horse seemed to be out of the barn. They're there, they're paying. And then when I really started to think about it, there are lots of things that families, students can do, parents can do, to try to simplify this whole idea of, you know, those of us in finance think about return on investment. We think about fancy calculations. And I think if you boil it down to a much simpler equation where you don't need a calculator and you think about it conceptually and practically, you can actually take some very concrete actions to increase the ROI. And it's actually pretty simple, Amy, when you think about it. When you think about return on investment, it's about minimizing, for students anyway, the total amount they pay for college, the cost, and then how they can increase their income earned from their college experience, which in effect is their return on that investment.
So take us through some of those tactics. There are some that are really, really interesting that I don't think I've really thought much about or seen anywhere else.
One of the things is for you.
Uh-oh, John, it looks like you stumbled into a weird cell phone zone. Can you move back to where you were standing a second ago?
I hadn't moved, so I'm sorry about
that.
There
you go. Perfect.
Okay, great. Yeah, I was saying that graduating 4 years is actually the first order of business for students. Interestingly and unfortunately, about 60% of students take 6 years to graduate. And it turns out, obviously, if you can just stay for 4 years, You're going to minimize the cost by just paying for four, not five or six. And also, you're not going to give up that opportunity cost of having a job in the fifth or sixth year. So that's one, I think, very important fact. Try to get into school and get out within 4 years. The second is maintaining whatever eligibility you might have for financial aid that you received from that university that first accepted you. And number one on that list, Amy, is that all listeners should know that on October 1 of every year, so just earlier this month, the FAFSA form, the free application for federal student aid, became available. And that's really the baseline that every student needs to file to be eligible for federal aid. So that's very important as well. But then there are some other things that I think parents can do to help with this as well. One of those, I have a wallet full of credit cards, and frequent flyer miles accrue as benefits to some of those. But there are some cards that will allow you to actually tie your benefits to either paying down a student loan or making a deposit to a college savings account.
I think that one is so important and one we don't think about often. There's so many different ways to maximize just credit cards we're going to be using anyway, on the spending we're doing anyway day to day. And that one is I really like that one. I think that one's really important to consider.
Yeah, and like you said, it's easy. I don't change my spending habit. I just redirect the benefit for a period of time. So even if it's just a cashback card, I could take that cash back and either give it to my daughter, who's right now a junior in college, for a little extra spending money. But all of this is tied to the concept, Amy, of trying to minimize the amount of debt that students and parents are taking to complete their college education. So again, the things like using cash back on a credit card or another that may not be particularly intuitive for parents is this idea of thinking about that payment plan that the college will offer. So I received my daughter's tuition and fee, room and board charges a while ago. And right in that envelope, there was an opportunity to sign up for a payment plan. They said, rather than pay a lump sum, I can pay this for months. And when some folks get into this idea of how they're going to use current income, that might be a great way to do that. So you know what? I'll sign up for this payment plan. I'll pay a little bit over each of the 5 months. And then I won't have to borrow as much to make that one lump sum payment. So that's another one that sometimes slips through the cracks when you open that invoice and say, oh, no, I've got another bill to pay. How am I going to do this? For some families, that might make a lot of sense.
Certainly. And also you list things about paying interest on loans while still in school and things like the Career Resource Center at the school, becoming an RA to defray some of those costs, things like that are really smart to think about. Sometimes I think students regard that as like, oh, just another thing to take on, just another thing to bother with. I'm just trying to get out here. But those are really important and they can save significant dollars on that bill.
No question about that. And as I said in that blog post, it surprised me when my older daughter called us and said, oh, by the way, I've got a job as an RA next year. And I realized that was in her private four-year school, that was a pretty significant reduction in the cost, which means that was a reduction in what some families might have to borrow to make those payments. So that's great. And the other ancillary benefit, Amy, is that it's a leadership position. It's working with other kids and with the administration. And that's a great topic on a job interview when you talk about what leadership you might have or experience you've had dealing with tough circumstances. RAs are full of opportunities to deal with tough circumstances. So it's actually, I think, a double win for students who are able to get those kinds of jobs.
Right. And really exercise those leadership skills early, for sure. So tell us a bit more about Invite Education and what people can expect to learn there at that site.
Well, Amy, thanks. I've been on this mission with the others in education for just about 6 years now, and my background was one where I spent a lot of time helping families.
Uh-oh. I'm afraid we lost you. Oh, you're back? Nope. Well, it looks like we've got kind of a tricky connection, but everybody head to Invite Education online. You can find it. A lot of interesting resources there for parents, for students, for parents and students planning to be college students soon or who are already there, or even for people who have already graduated looking for just kind of ways to very smartly pay down that debt. A lot of resources, and they're all over social media. So check them out for sure. Again, that's Invite Education, and I will tweet out a link to them if you follow me on Twitter. All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how Snapchat has managed to really avoid getting into the fake news stuff. They've really avoided all that mud. So we're going to talk about that in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. You know, we have talked quite a bit on this show about social media platforms and tech giants, and we've certainly talked quite a bit about the fake news phenomenon slash crisis slash pandemic. Certainly no shortage of information there and things to talk about. But there is a story that is on Bloomberg right now that is really, really interesting, and I encourage you to go check it out. I'll tweet it out later after the show. But it is by regular contributor to this show, Max Chafkin, and it is all about how Snapchat has managed to keep itself free of fake news. When we're looking at other platforms that are so enmeshed with, and there's so much going on there with fake news where it's hard to tell what's real and what's not, Snapchat has really managed to avoid a lot of that. Max, welcome back to the program.
Hey, how's it going, Amy?
Great, great. Always great to hear from you. Great to have you on the show. So talk us through this. Why has Snapchat managed to avoid this where things like Facebook and Twitter have, that's kind of the default?
So the simplest answer to that question is journalists. Snapchat hires journalists who basically do the basic work of that like a typical television producer or magazine or newspaper editor do, and they sift through videos and posts and decide what is newsworthy and what is true. Snapchat, unlike Facebook, and this is probably the most important distinction, Facebook kind of deliberately blurs the line between news and, say, photos of your friend's wedding or, crazy political rants of your, third cousin once removed. It all gets sort of stuck into this, quote unquote news feed. And that's part of the problem. That's what makes it so easy for propaganda artists to create stuff that on Facebook looks real. Snapchat takes, I think you might call it a more conventional or more traditional approach, at least traditional in terms of regular media, which is that there's basically a division between, the stuff that your friends are doing and then the professional media content, which is kind of walled off on the site. So they have deals with, the Wall Street Journal and The Economist and People and The Daily Mail. And those outlets are making content that lives in a separate sort of side of Snapchat. And then you have editors inside of Snapchat going through user posts and pulling stuff that looks newsworthy and that looks, most importantly, looks real into that kind of verified section. So it's a little bit like safer and a little bit less wild than what you'd be used to on, say, Twitter or Facebook, which is kind of weird considering Snapchat's, reputation as being this, disappearing messaging platform. Of course, it was popular for sexting and all sorts of, shady uses. That was the big narrative when it was started, 5 years ago.
Right, right. Certainly. That was, I think a lot of people avoided it because they sort of had this reputation as sort of this hookup thing. And now it's so interesting because for as much as we praised Twitter and Facebook for really democratizing information and making it so accessible that anyone could share anything, now it seems like here we have this really interesting moment where Snapchat is actually coming out ahead in terms of credibility by walling it off, by making it very separate and not doing that so much.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We make this point in the story, but Facebook actually has tried to do things like this. I mean, one thing, the sort of big narrative on Wall Street about Snapchat is that it's basically a disaster. And the reason it's a disaster financially is because Facebook has kind of meticulously copied many of their features. So the disappearing message function, there are all these kind of quirky, they're called augmented reality features, but you can like sort of stick a dancing hot dog in your Snap. Facebook has done things like that. One thing that they did last year, or actually they've been doing for a couple of years, they got into trouble for it last year, was this thing called trending topics, which was basically a little sidebar,
you know, inside of your Facebook feed, and that was curated by journalists. But then there was outcry, especially from conservatives, outcry on the right, that it was biased, and Facebook basically apologized and laid off its entire staff. And I think that, you know, when you look at what happened in the months that followed, that was in August, just a couple of months before the election, I think it was unfortunate. I mean, there's lots of, you know, magazines and newspapers are able to kind of navigate charges of bias without shutting the whole thing down. But Facebook, I think, was so worried about the outcry, and they have such an important, such a big business by sort of catering to all sides that they weren't willing to take the risk.
Right. And, you know, we're sitting here talking about Facebook and Twitter so much, which I think rightly so. But I think we should also, as you have done in the story, include Google News in that conversation, too, because we often, not as often, but sometimes nonetheless, we do see stories of really not credible origin appearing in Google News and as like highly cited and very popular topics, articles on topics.
Yeah, absolutely. So we made a point in the story that during the Charlottesville, the white nationalist march and then counter march and then murder that happened in Charlottesville, you know, Snapchat actually broke some news and did it in a really responsible way. Meanwhile, Google, the day after the Charlottesville, I'm mixing up my stories, but Google also distributed some fake news. But then during the Vegas shooting, Google News published a news story that originally appeared on 4chan, which, if you know anything about internet culture, is kind of like the lowest of the low. It's known for, you know, a lot of racism, a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of misogyny. I mean, it kind of makes, you know, Alex Jones look like a responsible newsman, and they accused an innocent person of being the Las Vegas shooter, and that appeared as a top story on Google News. And what's so kind of terrible about this, Google apologized, of course, they said they're going to do better, but I mean, we've all come to trust Google and Facebook to such an extent to get this stuff right, and they've managed to build these enormous businesses worth, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, and yet we're learning, and I think we will learn more with these hearings that are coming up, that it's possible to game these things, and that I think they haven't spent as much time as they probably should have, you know, securing their platform from, you know, propagandists, people who are trying to manipulate the discourse in our society.
Certainly. And I think it's a really interesting moment to be talking about this, because I've even noticed language shifting so much, you know, often people are saying, oh, I read that on Facebook. I saw that on Facebook. Even when you're talking about credible stories, you know, I recently said, oh, did you read this New York Times story about blah, 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 blah? And the answer I got was, oh, yeah, I read that on Facebook. And so to me, that's kind of this tell that even the source of the information is so a secondary consideration and more of Facebook as this vehicle and this platform of itself, that to me, it's very important and very interesting that Snapchat has taken the wheel in this way to really make sure the information there is accurate and credible.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I'm a pretty sophisticated, I write about fake news a lot, and I even find myself sometimes falling for it. I mean, we are, these platforms are so good at getting you to believe them and getting you to trust them. The design is so clever that it's very easy to fall for it. And what Snapchat's done, it's not complicated. They're not spending huge amounts of money on, it's not like they have an enormous newsroom. They have fewer than 100 people on their content team. But instead, what they've basically done is organize the app to make the problem smaller so that really they don't have to police that much content. They just have to police the content that's inside its their news section. And they don't really bother with the stuff that you know you and your friends are doing. And so that's how they're simultaneously, you know, sort of sexting and hookups on one side of the app and kind of, you know, really good journalism on the other side. There's Peter Hamby there, who's kind of their main political journalist, has a weekly show called Good Luck America. It's, you know, it's a Snapchat show. It feels like it's on Snapchat, and yet it's really well done. It's really informative. It's you know, one of the better pieces of political journalism on television. And so it's kind of weird that this company that is, you know, at once just totally wild is also, you know, contributing to the discourse in a positive way.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to see someone is, because I think that's really important. And I feel like that's coming to a head sooner than later. At least I hope so. I think it's just we keep talking about it and it's reached such a peak and such a fever pitch that it seems like something's going to have to give here at some point.
Well, I think there are two things going to happen. I mean, one is we're going to see these congressional hearings, but I wouldn't expect that to be I don't think we're going to see fireworks. November 1st, Twitter, Google, and Facebook are all going to testify. They're putting their general counsels in front of Congress. So I think we're not going to see that much there. Special Prosecutor Mueller, though, is looking into sort of Russian activity on these platforms, and the sort of thought most people think what he's actually trying to do is sort of compare what the Trump campaign was doing and what the Russians were doing to see any signs of collusion. Now, whether or not there's collusion, I think that those findings, if and when they're made public, are going to be very interesting and open people's eyes to the ways that these things have been manipulated, and hopefully push the platforms to be a little bit more responsible.
Yeah, indeed. So thank you so much for being with us, Max Chafkin, reporter at Bloomberg. And again, if you follow me on Twitter, I will be sure and share this story a little bit after the show. Thanks so much, Max. Talk to you next time.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right. So we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, then turn things over to the Startup Showcase. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.